Podo. You're listening to The Election Tricycle with Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin and Rohan Venkat.
Hi, and welcome back to The Election Tricycle, where we're looking at the election of 2024, or elections, in the United States, India, and the United Kingdom. I'm Emily Tamkin. I'm a journalist based in Washington, D.C. Rohan, what is going on? Where are you?
I'm an Indian journalist. My name is Rohan Venkat, but I live and work out of Cairo in Egypt.
And I'm Tom Hamilton. I'm the British correspondent for The Election Tricycle, and I'm based in London. I'm a former staffer for the Labour Party in the UK.
And we are going to get into it this week, take you through the news of elections and electoral politics in our three countries. Rohan, you have a story and you're up first.
Yes, just as we started last week with a big story from India, there's another big one this week that I will try and again condense into something short that's sort of understandable to those who are not familiar with the ins and outs of Indian politics. So Nitish Kumar, who's the chief minister, which I think in the American context would be the equivalent of a governor, essentially the head of a state in India, the head of Bihar, which is this large North Indian state, population of 130 million. My favorite little bit of trivia about Bihar for Western audiences is it's where George Orwell was born. Nitish Kumar was in power there in an alliance with these opposition parties at the center, the parties that are arrayed against the BJP and Prime Minister Narendra Modi, decided this week to jump ship. He resigned as chief minister and then a few hours later was sworn back in as chief minister, this time in an alliance with the BJP and Modi's party. It's not the first time he's done this. He's basically been in power for the last two decades, switching back and forth between his alliances with the BJP and with these opposition parties. Again, I don't think there's a clear analogy for either of your electorates, but imagine if, you know, the Lib Dems had tied up with the Tories, then as soon as they were losing, decided to be in power with Labour, then when they lost, moved back to the Tories, and then, you know, switch back and forth like this. This is how he's essentially remained in power.
I think that's probably what they'd like to do.
Absolutely, except they were roundly thrashed when they did that the last time.
Wait, I have a question. Has he distinguished himself by the frequency with which he is switching his allegiances? And also, if so, are they not sick of it by now?
Yeah, so there's two things there. One, we have a famous phrase in Indian politics called Aaya Ram, Gaya Ram, which means someone has come and someone has left, and it refers to the act of switching parties in that case, not switching alliances. And so moving parties and switching allegiances is not unusual, but Nitish Kumar has certainly distinguished himself in how often he's done it and how blatantly maybe he's done it over the past 20 years. It's not a fundamental flaw of the system in the sense that because India does have a parliamentary system, like this is something that can happen, and we don't have a binary politics in the way America does, that it's not as unusual as someone going from the Democrats to the Republicans and back. But at the same time, it is also odd. I think I was trying to think of an American analogy here, and maybe a Joe Manchin might be the one. But what actually jumped out to me was more someone like Mitt Romney, who claims to be a never Trumper. But and Nitish Kumar was the same in the 2010 to 2015 period when he looked at Modi and he said, I will never work with that man because of his image with the minorities and so on. And then after a little while, he actually decided to work with Modi. Then a few years later, he jumped away from them, and now he's back working with them again. So it's really both a complex feature of Indian politics, but also this man in particular has managed to pull it off. Part of the reason is that a lot of North Indian states have a simple BJP Congress binary. That's not true in many other parts of India. But Bihar has not settled its social justice and broader politics to the extent that the electorate has become binary. And so he plays a sort of kingmaker in between role in that state.
Yeah. Can I ask a question about the dynamics of that? Does he carry an electorate with him, or is he following an electorate and moving to where the votes are? Who's leading here?
So it's again, a good question, because he has a small slice of the electorate that trusts him. A lot of politics in India is identity politics, again, in the sense of communities following leaders. The cliche used to be that you don't cast your vote, you vote your cast, which is not exactly true and often an unfounded cliche, but there's something to it in the way analysts look at Indian politics, which is that large caste communities tend to vote for parties that reflect their concerns. And Nitish Kumar built a small base amongst what's called the extremely backward classes, but this was never large enough for him to command majorities on his own. And so he does take that with him wherever he goes in a sense of that. And then he manages to pull in other support, but he's never won his state by himself, for example. He's always needed the help of the BJP on one side, which has, again, a certain base behind it, and the opposition parties, which have a slightly different base. The big implication for this, for the upcoming elections, well, there's two bits. One, Bihar was supposed to be one of those big states where the BJP could drop a number of seats or at least votes because he was not in the coalition with them. But maybe the more underlying thing, which again might be hard to explain in a short time, is that Bihar has a long history of social justice politics, which in India broadly portrayed through the tool of affirmative action, which is to say quotas for backward classes in government jobs and education.
Can you just briefly explain what you mean by backward class or extremely backward class?
Broadly speaking, the politics of India can divide amongst a couple of fault lines. We don't have that sort of simple left-right. One of those is religion. And so you have the classic sort of secular versus communal divide, which on one side is people who prefer religion not to be too much in politics, and the other side is the more Hindu nationalist side. But the other is more of the caste and class-based division in Indian politics, where the upper castes, your Brahmins is the one that's most familiar to people who are outside India, but there's other upper castes who have historically been socially and economically empowered, tended to have dominated spaces of public office as well as, you know, the economy and so on. At the very bottom of this community ladder, you have what used to be known as the untouchables, who are today called the scheduled castes and tribals. But in between the upper castes and the untouchables, there's a big mass of folks who were categorized as the other backward classes. This is the majority of Indians. The last time we had solid data on how many of Indians come into this category, it was in 1931 when the British did a census. And it was more than 50% of India. Today, we believe it's closer to 65-70% of Indians falling into this category, but we don't have that information. And that's relevant because one of the planks of the opposition is that we ought to conduct a census and find out what percentage of Indians fall into this other backward class category and give them a requisite amount of quotas within government jobs as well as educational institutions. The extremely backward classes that I mentioned earlier are a sliver at the bottom of this categorization, the OBCs being the short form that is used in India. And so Nitish Kumar and his party broadly set out to bring the rest of the alliance together on this social justice plank.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess the only other question I have is, like, it just sounds like, if I'm an opposition supporter in India listening to this, I guess my thought is, can nothing go right for us, right? Like, like another thing, right? Because you said that the BJP was going to drop seats in Bihar and perhaps now will drop fewer seats because Kumar decided to make the switch. So it's like, I guess, does this add to the narrative that this is just like a constant drumbeat in favor of the BJP as we head to elections in India?
Absolutely. What this does is it undercuts one of those key planks that they were hoping to build their entire election like identity around, which was calling for a caste census, counting how many castes are out there and building through that. Because historically, particularly in the 1980s and 90s, that was the way to fight against Hindu majoritarianism and Hindu nationalism. Because Hindu nationalists seek to take 80% of the population, that is the Hindu population, as their vote bank, the folks pushing social justice have historically sought to collect another 3/4 of the population, which is everyone except the upper castes in their broad coalition, including Muslims and non-Hindus. But the BJP has moved towards the center on this. This is one of those complex things where the BJP, in being a right-wing party, has often been quite progressive within the Hindu fold. What they do is they other Muslims, they're often demonizing Muslims, but then managing to be somewhat progressive and moving towards the center of questions about within the Hindu fold and on things like affirmative action. So it's not a clean fault line also. It's quite complex. But yeah, in terms of big picture for the opposition, It undercuts them in a major way because one of the big leaders has jumped over, and also one of those who had a strong argument to make in on favor of social justice has decided to work with the BJP.
Because it's not that uncommon for parties of the right to do things that are relatively beneficial and what might even say sort of progressive left wing, but towards the bits of the electorate that support them, whether it's helping pensioners in the NHS or I was interested in how that affirmative action debate plays out, because obviously, Emily, you'll know better than me that that's a big dynamic in US politics in relation to obviously slightly different groups who've been disadvantaged for slightly mm-hmm. different reasons. But does it play out in sort of left-right lines in the same way in India as it does in America, or is it different?
Yeah, no, it certainly doesn't. It did, maybe you could argue that it did in the 80s and the 90s. And that was one of the reasons that the BJP is so dominant as it is today, that on this factor, it has moved far to the center. Some have argued that the BJP is you know, reactionary on some issues, but progressive on others, and radical even on other grounds. In the 80s, the BJP was often tarnished with the tag of being a Brahmin Baniya party, a party of the upper castes. Today, it's a party that has changed a lot. Its internal structuring and its leadership, Modi himself, comes from the other backward class category. And it has worked to pull together a lot of folks from this world into its space, managing to do it using the rubric of Hindu nationalism to not upset the internal dissensions that might exist between these communities. So it's really using both the othering of Muslims and the broad idea of a Hindu nationalism and a more Hindu state to build this broader coalition that can exclude minorities within the country. And it evidently is successful.
I just think it's a really important point to stress that, like, it sounds like progress, but it's progress where somebody is still left out, right? It's progress on the condition that somebody still gets to be othered. I think, you know, I'm there are many, many differences between India and the United States, but there is a segment of the Republican Party that looks to Hungary and its more, you know, substantial support for the family, for example, and says, well, we should do something like that. But when they say the family and support for the family, they mean white, they mean heterosexual, they mean like the traditional nuclear white American family. If you just sort of skim a headline, yeah, it sounds like progress, it sounds progressive, it sounds like you're giving people support. It's a progress built on division still. And one could argue over whether that's progress at all.
Absolutely. It's contingent on it. In fact, it is in some ways the weaponizing of this fear of Muslims that keeps that flock together, and that will need to be continued to be whipped up, because otherwise what defines the Hindu right in that sense. But yeah, it's both a more complex story than just left-right, but at the same time, it's one that's like built on othering a large section of the community and weaponizing then violence and majoritarianism in that sense. So it's the TLDR in that sense is that this is a major setback for the opposition, and it has led to other members within the opposition starting to take pot shots at each other and not trust each other about being able to actually work together in the run-up to this election.
So we should always finish with a TLDR on each of the segments that people have. I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that this is not, in fact, the biggest story in India this week, because the biggest story in India this week is that the touring England cricket team overcame a 190-run first innings deficit to beat India in the first test, which, you know, has led to as much discussion of India in the UK media as we ever get, and a lot of fun. It's been too.
As ball strikes again.
I don't know how the Indians are reacting to that unexpected defeat.
It really was. It's one of those famous victories. Yeah, I think that will go down at least in British history here. And there's a lot of soul searching happening on the Indian side about it. So yeah, for those who you know want to take their minds away from the elections a little bit, we can watch our team lose. But you know, everyone's confident that we will roundly defeat the British in the rest of this series.
I mean, by the time we record our next episode, the second test I think will be over, and I may not be smiling as broadly as I am now. But it's not that common to be able to smile when touring India. So so let's take what we can get. I think it's my turn now, and what I was going to talk about this week, because this is a podcast about both our three elections that are going on this year, but also how they interact with each other and how they how different countries' politics are impinging on each other's. I thought I might have a bit of a look at the way that some politicians in the UK, particularly some Tory politicians in the UK, are talking about the US election, and in particular, the way that some of them are starting to talk about Donald Trump as potentially someone that they would like to see winning.
Okay, go ahead. If you must. No, I'm just kidding. Go on.
I know, it's interesting because the polls in the UK, if there are polls on what British people think about Donald Trump, and he's not popular in the UK. I mean, he would definitely not come close to winning a UK general election, and that's fine because he doesn't have to, it's not his job. But that does affect how people talk about him in politics. There's also a really important convention that applies to pretty much all foreign elections for governments and opposition parties, that if you're asked, you just don't express a view on other people's democratic process. The answer is, it's up to the people of that country to make a decision, and we'll work with whoever gets elected. And it's quite a boring answer, but it's clearly the right one, because in future, you just do have to work with those people and form alliances. But over the last few weeks, there's been quite a lot of Tory politicians, including some quite prominent ones, coming out in favour of Donald Trump and saying nice things about him. So a week or two ago, Boris Johnson, who used to be the Prime Minister of the UK, but is now a very highly paid Daily Mail columnist, who writes about politics to the Daily Mail rather less than I think the Daily Mail would have hoped when they announced his contract. He had a long piece the other week about whether it was okay to have a wood-burning fire in your house, which whatever you think about whether there should be a wood-burning fire in your house, you probably wouldn't have chosen Boris Johnson to be your main correspondent on that topic. But a week or two ago, he wrote about Donald Trump and said actually that it might be a good thing for the world if Donald Trump were elected. And part of that is about what he calls the Negroni sipping wokearty who might be disappointed by a Trump victory because, you know, all these lefty liberals will be weeping into their posh drinks.
But how is that good for the world? How, other than like having some people be aggrieved, is that a benefit?
It is not obvious to me how a lefty feeling upset is either good or bad for anyone, really, in the grand scheme of things. But yeah, he said it could be a big win for the world and expressed vague confidence that actually Ukraine would be fine, even though, as you will know, Donald Trump has made noises about Ukraine and resolving that war, which a lot of Europeans, let alone Ukrainians, are quite nervous about. Liz Truss has come out to say that she would like to see a Trump win. Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's a former cabinet minister, has said that he would quite like Trump to win because Biden has shown his dislike for the UK, which seems to me to be overinterpreting to a huge extent some of the things that Biden has said about his own sort of Irish ancestry. And then the Tory mayoral candidate in London, Susan Hall, has also come out in favour of Trump. And part of that is that Sadiq Khan, who she's fighting against, has been not only quite anti-Trump, but Trump, when he was president, was quite anti-Khan. So there was a bit of a sort of a personal rift there. So all of these people have come out in favour of Trump in ways that you would think were not all that helpful to the Tories, given where Trump is. And in fact, you might say that in some cases, it's not necessarily that helpful to Trump either. I mean, Liz Truss, who was prime minister for all of 49 days in the UK, a bit more than a year ago, and was by no stretch of the imagination a successful leader of the right in this country. Having her endorsement may not be all that helpful.
I'm going to be honest. I don't think it's going to help or hurt. I don't think that most Americans, they just don't know who she is. It's not good or bad. Boris Johnson, I think there is some familiarity. It's just striking that, okay, like this is not a serious group of people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, this is not the kind of thing that you're spending your time on if you're trying to get your party to remain in power. This is not, if you have great policies and platforms, you're not like, yeah, maybe it would be good if Donald Trump came back. Like, it just strikes me as kind of like imitating American culture wars,
yeah,
and imitating American sort of, again, politics of grievance. And it's just quite superficial. And it got attention. We're talking about it, but for political reasons, it's just, you know, yeah, not to quote Succession, but like they're just not serious people.
I think that's totally right. There was another really interesting little snippet of sort of culture war engagement and America engagement in the last week or so when Keir Starmer made a speech last Monday about it was about various things and sort of civil society, but one of the things that he talked about was that various right-wing people have been taking on, not just the Tories to be fair, have been criticizing the wokeness of certain UK charities, the National Trust, got into trouble for trying to contextualise aspects of British history that are to do with slavery and colonialism. The RNLI, who are the lifeboats, the lifeboat charity, the people who rescue people from the sea, got into trouble a couple of years ago with some aspects of the right for the fact that, some of the people that were rescuing from the sea were refugees. And to be fair, that wasn't a mainstream Tory position, but people attacked them. But anyway, Starmer talked about the negative coverage that some of these things have got in, from the right, and talked about a McCarthyist strain in right-wing politics, obviously a reference to Senator Joe McCarthy in the 50s. We have very erudite references. Now, these are people referring back to before Starmer was even born. But there was a really interesting response to it from Robert Jenrick, who is another Tory former cabinet minister, in the Telegraph. And I'm intrigued, Emily, in whether McCarthy ever gets remotely good press in the States. He doesn't get a good press here. But Jenrick said that actually McCarthy was correct to say that there was an infiltration of American institutions. And I'm quoting, "In fact, he underestimated the degree to which America's civic bodies and government departments have been compromised by leftist intelligentsia. And contrary to Starmer's reading of history, McCarthy himself was not the protagonist. Communist subversives were."
No, here it's understood that, like, you're not supposed to say that Joe McCarthy was good. but the same attack, like, again, in terms of imitation, this sounds very similar to Trump's attack on the so-called deep state and to Republicans' attacks on civil servants and so on and so forth. So I think by and large, most politicians know better than to say, like, yes, I think Joe McCarthy was doing something grand, but the attack itself is very similar.
So I think it's worth sort of reflecting on why it is that certain people on, not in the cabinet, to be fair, but in the Tory party in relatively prominent positions, are coming out in favour of what might be a mainstream debate in US politics. Trump good, bad is a real thing in US politics, but it's not that mainstream in the UK. And why are they doing it? And I think it does feel quite self-indulgent, but part of it is that they really do think it. They really do want Trump to win. You know, the fact that it's a minority view, everything's a minority view, but it doesn't mean that some people don't hold it. These people really would like to see a Trump presidency, regardless of the fact that most UK citizens wouldn't. And it's people who, in many cases, have been in government, but they're not in government anymore. They've got the freedom to do that. But it also, I think, it really tells you something about the state of the Conservative Party in an election year, that there's this much sort of indiscipline going on, that they're not taking the government line of, we will work with whoever wins these various foreign elections and that's the end of the story. They're acting in a really indisciplined way, and it shows you that for a lot of Tories already, it feels like the really big election this year isn't the general election or even the US general election. It's the leadership election that comes afterwards, and they're playing to the audience that will decide who the next leader is.
Right.
Ever since the fall of Boris Johnson, really, the Conservative Party in the UK has been fighting its own leadership election and pandering to its own members.
But may I just ask, it just doesn't seem like I think even, we talked about this last week, I think even in the United States, in many quarters, people are tired of the sort of like anti-wokeness line of campaign, because it's not relevant to most people's lives. And this doesn't mean that the quote-unquote anti-woke candidate never wins, but I think most Americans prefer sort of like a civil libertarianism. And if you actually poll them, like, they don't really care that much about DEI. They're not that invested in having gay people's rights being taken away. Now, on the one hand, that's bad, right? Everybody should be invested in protecting those rights. But on the other hand, it means that there's this sort of ennui with this line of attack. And it seems to me like in the United Kingdom, it never really took, like, save for sort of anti-trans attacks, which strike me as quite salient in UK politics. Generally speaking, the sort of anti-woke line of attack, it just, you would know better than I, but it just seems like UK voters never really bought it. It raises the question then of why double down on that being your approach if you want to be leader of one of the main parties?
Because I think basically because there are different incentives going on. You're totally right that the public doesn't care about most of this stuff, or cares to the extent that they might read the papers that it's in, and some examples of wokeness are quite funny, and you can be a little bit outraged about it without thinking that it should be a sort of a national government policy response to it. It's more a joke. But on a level of policy, people are not deciding their votes on this basis. But it is a way of getting an audience. If you're in a particular bit of the sort of the right wing or left wing, actually, but in the media sphere, it's a thing that you can talk about. And if you've taken your eye off the ball of governing and your metrics are different, and your metrics are, what's the audience? Am I getting engagement on my tweets? Then yeah, you should definitely go on about that. I mean, I think there are lots of examples of sort of particular issues that fall into the woke box that get a huge amount of Twitter engagement, social media engagement, and so on. And there's a small number of people who are really, really engaged and excited about it on both sides. But certainly in the UK, the electorate isn't all that bothered. And we can have a different argument about whether they should be bothered. But from an electoral point of view, one of the things that Keir Starmer especially has tried to do over the last few years, I think, is to just stay out of those debates completely, give a really boring answer if absolutely pushed, and if not pushed, just not talk about it at all. There was an example of him quite early on in his leadership taking the knee at the time when it was on the day of George Floyd's funeral. Actually, there's a photo taken of him taking the knee along with his deputy, Angela Rayner. That photo still gets used by the right as an example of, you know, what a woke warrior he is. But what to me is striking about that is that there hasn't been anything like that for 3 years, 4 years, however long it is, 3.5 years.
Slightly cynical Indian journalists reading, again, this is complete hypothesis, but you spoke earlier about how the polite thing to do would be to say we're not involved in other people's elections. We do know that Trump is not polite in this way at all. And I wonder if some of it is not, you know, he's very transactional. And if some of it is not also to get Trump and his media audience to pay attention to this person in the UK, whether there's an element of that, or even folks who'd like to do some of that work in the broader, you know, how we often say that people in the Republican Party are just auditioning for a Fox News spot, you know, at the end of the day, it jumps out to me that you know, people in the UK might be doing the same.
Well, in the UK, you get Tory MPs auditioning for a GB news spot, where quite a few of the presenters now are actual serving Tory MPs, who are also being paid to be TV presenters, which is quite unusual in this country. I think one of the dynamics that's going to get really interesting, we might return to closer to the US election, is the US and the UK elections are going to happen at more or less the same time, probably. But I think these questions are going to keep coming back, and they're going to be a problem for both parties. Questions about how will you work with whoever wins? And both saying, go Trump, and saying, I hope he doesn't win, for different people in UK politics are going to cause diplomatic problems.
We also have, like, for example, Senator Ted Cruz from Texas has a podcast that he promotes often.
There's nothing wrong with promoting a podcast.
Nothing wrong with promoting a podcast. But if you're ostensibly a politician who's interested in governing, it raises some questions. But speaking of politicians from Texas, so the story that I wanted to talk about this week, the short version is that Texas has been using wire and state agents to block Border Patrol, U.S. Border Patrol, from getting to a section of the U.S.-Mexico border in Eagle Pass, which is a city in Texas. And the Supreme Court sided with the federal agents in saying that the razor wire had to be removed. However, Governor Greg Abbott is doubling down, even though Homeland Security has said, no, really, we want access to this area. Now, I am not in Texas, and so I reached out to a friend of mine, Texas-based journalist Christopher Hooks, and sort of asked him to give me the Texas politics version of it, and then I'll briefly read this, and then I'll sort of say what I think it means for the broader U.S. election. So he said, I think the thing I'd say is that this is really all about Texas politics. The state has been deploying resources to the border for about 15 years, but it's really intensified in the last few years as Greg Abbott has realized it has a lot of political utility for him. And basically, he explained that he's a pretty weak governor and is actually not that effective, but he knows that he can always send guys with guns to the border and get invited on Fox News. So at first, he would just send more and more guys. This is Chris writing. And then he started doing stunts. So there's boys in the river, forcing a special forces team to go and plant a Texas flag on an island in the river. And these stunts can be dangerous and bad. Like if you put up barbed wire, they hurt children who are trying to cross the border. These things were bad, but they were stunts. And the latest is too, but it's much bigger and more dangerous. He's using state cops and state soldiers to keep the Border Patrol off a pretty sizable section of the river near Eagle Pass. This could become a constitutional crisis if the court cracks down, but right now it's a standoff. Politically, it's a donation to Trump because it centers the border in national discourse, but it's also not just about national politics. It's a high point of the Republican primary in Texas, and Abbott is trying to fundraise and get his friends elected to the legislature. I would just add to this that Biden does not want this to become the major domestic political story, because even though Biden has actually been a complete disappointment to immigration rights advocates, and even though he has basically not changed much of Trump's very draconian immigration or anti-immigration policy, the Democratic Party is still seen as softer on immigration than the Republican Party is. And I would say that they're probably less openly cruel about wanting to stop migrants from coming in rhetoric, if not in policy and practice. And that means that if there's a border crisis on a Democratic president's watch, like that's not good for the Democratic president at the polls. And this is an interesting issue, I think, in that it's not like this will really bring out liberal and leftist voters. Most Americans don't come out to vote for migration and for immigration. And so what you're left is a standoff where people are getting hurt. There is no reason to think that if Trump comes back to power, that this would not find a way to get worse. I should also say that in Congress, they're negotiating over like immigration border legislation. And Trump has reportedly reached out to Republicans and said, don't agree to anything. Don't make a deal. Now, if you're a Republican legislator, either you really think this is a crisis that needs to be dealt with now and requires legislation and requires funding, or you don't really think it's a crisis and it's just politics. And that's why you're listening to Trump. But like, then it's not a crisis.
What does Trump want to do?
Trump wants this to become a major story. His last time was building a wall. There was a clip that went viral of one Democratic politician in Congress sort of listing out the things that Trump has proposed, like shooting people on the legs, like sending alligators into the river, making a more dangerous wall, getting tougher on Mexico. And his interlocutor, who was a migration rights person, was basically saying that all of these things are either totally illegal and or would make the situation worse and would actually drive migration. Like if you create more unstable conditions in Mexico, that just drives more migration to the United States. I don't think that Trump is interested in resolving this at all.
In the last election in 2020, obviously there was all the build the wall stuff, and they didn't build, as far as I know, most of the wall, if any of the wall.
In fact, Steve Bannon's Build the Wall campaign turned out to be a fraudulent enterprise that got him charged. So,
which is not ideal. But my question about that is, was the fact that on the one hand, Trump talked a really good game on immigration, but on the other hand, he didn't do some of the things that he said he was going to do. Did that help Biden in the 2020 election, or was it still a positive for Trump?
I don't think immigration mattered that much in the 2020 election, to be honest. I think it was really about COVID. It was about, I think it was about feeling like not just that leadership was bad, but that it was completely out to lunch. I still think that if we had not been in a global crisis, that people, and if the economy was good enough, he would have won again. I should also say that although there are some things that he said he would do and he didn't, Trump and Stephen Miller, who was his White House advisor, who hates immigration, he's the one, if you don't know if you remember the story, but his uncle wrote an essay that was like, our family was Jewish immigrants. You're a complete disgrace to our family and a complete hypocrite.
Yeah.
That's Stephen Miller. So he and Trump and the Trump Homeland Security Department basically ended asylum as we know it by basically they invoked a title that's meant to be for health crises because of COVID. And the Biden administration has largely tried to keep that in place. And again, I don't think that they're, unfortunately, for people who care about the right to seek asylum, which is, you know, under international law people have, or the conditions of immigrants, I don't think that this is a really galvanizing issue. There was the whole moment of when it came out that children were being kept in cages on the border, and the, you know, people went to the border and saw and recorded the cries and, oh my goodness, this is horrible. How could this be happening? And it was horrible and it was happening. But, you know, I think our immigration policies are still pretty disappointing to immigration rights advocates and to people who care about the right of people to safely cross a border.
There was some chatter, correct me if I'm wrong, but there was some chatter about Texas maybe becoming purple. Maybe I'm wrong around the last election or more significant numbers of...
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. Okay, so basically for years, people would say like, is this the election where Texas turns blue? Blue in the United States being the color of the Democratic Party. It's a little confusing because it's sort of the reverse.
Always confusing for us.
Yeah, it's the reverse in the UK. And I think part of the logic was because of demographics, because it's a young, you know, if a state has a younger population, if a state has a non-white population, which Texas does, they'll vote for Democrats. There's all sorts of things that are so interesting about Texas politics. But one of the things that people found in the 2020 election is that just because a family was Hispanic, just because there was a person who had immigrated from Mexico in the family, or if somebody's parents were, that did not mean that they were going to vote for the Democrats. And it did not even mean that they were going to be more supportive of more liberal immigration policies. And I think it varies from North and Central and South American community to community, but there is a sense of many of like, well, I came here, but now sort of shut the door behind me, either because they came legally and resent those who are trying to come in an undocumented fashion, or because it's like, well, I'm here, you know, no more. And there's some really great reporting after the election that basically suggested that the Texas Mexican community or Texas Mexican American community really resented being seen as Mexican, right? They really resented the idea that like you're going to come here and assume that I'm, that my policies are XYZ. Like, I never expected Georgia to go blue before Texas, but it did. Mm-hmm. Or Arizona before Texas, it did. I really don't think this helps Texas become purple or blue any faster. Okay. So normally, as I said last week, normally this will be where our podcast ends and we will move into material for premium subscribers. But this week and next, it's for everyone. So as a reminder, in our premium listener section that everyone is listening to right now, we will have two bonus features. And the first is a listener question. You can always submit by tweeting at one of us, reaching out. And this week, our question from an anonymous listener, and it is, why do Trump and his supporters care about Taylor Swift? How could you not? Listen to those bops. No, the actual answer is that, okay, so after about a decade of dating various British actors and musicians, Taylor Swift is dating.
And good for them, let's just say.
I saw a funny tweet that when she got with her current boyfriend that was like, oh no, boyfriends for Taylor are one of our most important exports. But anyway, she's not dating any of them now. She's dating Travis Kelce, who plays for the Kansas City Chiefs. The Kansas City Chiefs are in Kansas City. It's like in the middle of the country. You would think that this would not be offensive to anybody, but they're dating. But it is in some cases because the very far right doesn't like him because he did a pro-vaccine, like a pro-COVID vaccine, save your life and get vaccinated campaign. She also endorsed Biden in 2020, and she's come out in support of gay rights. She's come out in support of a person's right to abortion and to reproductive access. I would say that she's like vaguely liberal in terms of what we know of her politics. And so her dating Travis is very offensive to some people. They also show her sometimes when she, like, if she's at the game, the NFL will pan to her. Like, if Kelce scores, you know, they'll show her being like, yay. And this has infuriated people. This has driven people up the wall, like, out of the house. People are, they're like, she's ruining football. I saw a very funny thing, like, a clip from a Fox journalist who basically said of the idea that Taylor Swift would endorse Biden in 2024, why would she do that? Why would she polarize her fan base like this? Sir, obviously you do not watch the classic Taylor Swift documentary, Miss Americana, because if you did, you would know that before she made her first endorsement against Senator Marsha Blackburn, her father told her, don't do this, don't alienate part of your fan base, just be like Bing Crosby, kind of an outdated reference if we're being honest, like, come on, Papa Swift. And she did it anyway because she said, no, this is really important to me. She then went on to endorse Biden in 2020. And then made $1 billion on her tour. Like, she's fine. You know what I mean? It is very funny to me that there are right-wing Americans who are like, we have to root for the San Francisco 49ers. Are you kidding me? San Francisco is one of the most derided cities in this country for the political right. Because they're like, it's gay and the crime and it's California. Like, it's a fever dream for the far right in this country. And they are pulling for the Niners because they can't stand the idea that Taylor Swift might be dating somebody on the Kansas City Chiefs and the Kansas City Chiefs still win. That's why Trump and his supporters care.
It just doesn't strike me as being that surprising that a youngish woman in the music industry is broadly pro-Democrat. It wouldn't be the first thing that I worried about if I were a Republican strategist. I would sort of price that in, I think.
Well, okay, it's two things. One, it's because she came out of the country music world. And two, it's because I think, in fact, I don't think I know, that there are people in this country who projected onto her like she's an Aryan goddess, which is a bizarre thing to think about anybody. Let's just put that out there. Like, yeah. Honestly, like, take a moment, sit with yourself if that thought crosses your mind.
Being white isn't inherently white supremacist in itself.
Right, right. Like, she's just blonde. You know what I mean? But I think that it's been a real journey for, you know, people who watch football, for people who are on the political right, who honestly, they have made, like, the anger around this issue has made Taylor Swift fans, famously known as the Swifties, seem calm. And I don't know if you've ever encountered the Swifties, but they're not like...
I've observed them from a distance.
They're not the calmest group, but they, compared to this crew, they're like quite chill. So anyway, that's my answer to the queue. The second special feature that we have for premium listeners, but today for all of you, each week we will very briefly introduce you to a character from one of our three countries of whom you may not have heard before. Tom, take it away.
Yeah, this podcast is a bit like Twitter in that the game is not to be the main character. And the loser of the game this week, the main character this week in UK politics is a previously relatively obscure Tory MP and former minister called George Freeman, who was, until November last year, was the science minister. He's held a range of different roles. And he stood down in November. But this week, he wrote a blog saying that one of the reasons that he'd stood down as a minister was that his mortgage payment had gone up from £800 a month to £2,000 a month, which, to be fair, is quite a big rise in a mortgage payment, and that he couldn't afford it on a ministerial salary. Now, the salary of a minister at the level that he was at in the UK is £118,300. I'm not going to translate that into dollars or rupees, but let's just say quite a large salary in terms of national averages. I looked it up. It puts him in the top 3% of earners in the UK. So quite a lot of money, and yet resigning because he couldn't afford to pay his mortgage. Now, he wrote about how this showed that access to a political career is now too much for normal people. But I think that's quite a parochial way of him for him to look at it, given that it also shows that people in the top 3% of national income can't afford to pay their mortgages because of enormous rises in interest rates that have happened. Now, you can blame the Conservative Party or not according to taste, but basically since Liz Truss's premiership and the things that she did in her slightly disastrous mini budget, interest rates have gone up really significantly since then. And that's when he and many others have been priced out of the mortgage market. And so what this shows is that even for a Tory minister, the cost of living trumps everything. And that is what the electorate are telling us as well. I think we're all going to miss George Freeman a bit. Shortly after the story broke, there was another brilliant story about him, which was that he had accidentally shared in a WhatsApp group of Tory MPs, he'd accidentally shared a letter endorsing himself for a knighthood, which he had presumably intended to send to someone else. He's managed to distinguish himself on a number of occasions. I first noticed him because there was articles that kept on popping up in which he would appear and it would emerge that he'd written a memo to the Prime Minister. And over the period in question, there have been several Prime Ministers. He's the kind of person who writes memos to the Prime Minister telling them how they should change their strategy. I think we've all met people like that. But this week, he's managed to become UK politics' main character by virtue of, thanks to the Liz Truss crash, he is now one of the victims who's unable to pay his mortgage. Like millions of people around the country, he's now the poster boy for high interest rates in a way that he really should have predicted when he wrote it down, but he didn't.
Well, George Freeman, those of us who didn't already know you, hardly knew ye. Rohan, will you get us out of here?
Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Election Tricycle. You can get all of our work on our Substacks, which we'll link to in the show notes. And we look forward to catching up more on our democracies next week.
The Election Tricycle is a Poddo podcast hosted by Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin, and Rohan Venkat. It is series produced by Nick Hilton. Tweet us at Tricycle2024 and watch a video version of the show at cooler.news. For sales and advertising, please email nick@podopods.com. podopods.com.